Okay, everybody. Hello. Welcome. I am delighted and honored to be here with you, as always. First, I think two emails that I'd like to read and talk about a little bit. I know that there are, well, I'm not sure whether I've spoken about this before, but I know that there's at least one person who may or may not be here who would prefer that I just sermonize rather than read emails. And if you are here and you are the one, just understand this, that first of all, you can be sure that I will do quite a bit of sermonizing in regard to emails that I read. And secondly, although I seem to talk an awful lot, I really have very, very little to say, except in response to what you have to say, except in response to what you have to report, and in response to the problems that you bring to me. The actuality of what I come here to speak of is simple beyond comprehension, literally simple beyond comprehension, and therefore is extremely difficult to talk about. The only thing that I really want to talk about is not reality or anything like that, but what can be done to be finished with misery, fearfulness, and anxiety here and now in this life. What can be done that actually works pragmatically to relieve us of this undercurrent of the feeling of being at risk, in danger, trapped in these lives, trapped in these minds, subject to and at the mercy of the ever-changing circumstance in which we seem to appear. And that's really simple. And that really doesn't require a lot of conversation, but nevertheless, we converse. An email, short email. I have been searching for a while now, and your simple directness has been a breath of fresh air for me. There is one thing about which I'm confused, though. The term inquiry implies that we inquire into or investigate the nature of reality from the standpoint of not yet knowing or realizing that nature. But when you say we should taste the reality of what we are, this seems to imply already know or realizing that reality and taking time to experience it. Could you clarify this, please, since I really don't know how to taste that reality, only to search for it and ask what it is in the hope that the answer will occur to me. Well, I hardly know where to start with this email because there's a lot that I actually would have to say about it. First of all, it is true that the term inquiry is an unfortunate, in my view anyway, not in everybody's, but in my view, an unfortunate misunderstanding of the essential nature of the vichara that Ramana's insight penetrated. The term self-inquiry, I believe, was just a misguided effort to translate literally a Sanskrit term, atma-vichara, which arises a very long time ago with Shankara as a technique for clearing the window between you and your true self. The attempt at literal translation of that Sanskrit term into the expression self-inquiry leads us down quite a few false trails. First of all, at least in American English, perhaps not so much in British English, but I'm not sure of that, but at least in American English, the term inquiry contains the idea of ongoing investigation into the nature of something, or the source of something, or the outcome of something, an ongoing investigation into something that will lead to a solution or a revelation or something of the kind. The vichara of Ramana Maharshi has nothing whatsoever to do, in my experience, with learning the relationships or the nature of anything whatsoever. It is, as you say, that, or as you seem to realize, it is the case that there is absolutely nothing about you that you don't already know. It is the case that in all cases when we are looking for something to free us from the sense of being trapped and lost and at the mercy of circumstance and my stupidity and my conditioning and all of the other things that we have identified to be the proximate cause of our misery, and we are searching for a final and fundamental and limitless resolution to that. What we are always searching for, no matter what we think, what we are always searching for is the actuality of ourself, not our big self or our little self or our ego self or any self whatsoever except you, just as you are. The you that's always here, the you that's never absent, the you that never changes. And the purpose of this is not in any way to unravel or dispense with any mystery about what I am, or any misunderstanding even about what I am. It is actually, the purpose of this is to eradicate this underlying belief, an underlying belief that I am at stake here, I am in danger here, and that I must do something to find my way out of here, or to define myself, to create myself, to establish an identity for myself that is satisfactory and that provides me with the opportunity to get the fulfillment that life seems to promise, the peace and understanding and clarity that life seems to promise and never deliver. The purpose, therefore, of the vichara, as far as the enactment of the vichara in the sense of personal consciousness, the purpose of the vichara is actually to settle the issue of identity. To just settle it, not to find out what we are, but to be finished with the idea that we must find out what we are, to settle the issue of identity. You are, after all of you, all of us, all human beings for certain, you are, after all, identity itself. You are that which bestows identity on everything else. You are that which bestows identity on thought, on emotion, on sensation, on stars and planets and galaxies and plants and light and gravity and the entire panoply of display that is this magnificence of creation, of existence. You are the source of identity. You are identity itself. Now, when I have said, taste the reality of what you are, I have a great deal of difficulty expressing clearly what it is that I want everybody to do, because it seems a foolishness to me to think that I can tell you where to find you or how to look at you. I mean, what I am asking you to look at is you, not something that you understand yourself to be, not something that you have read or heard or thought yourself to be, but to look at the irreducible essence of you, which is here always, which never changes, which is far too simple to be contained within any prettified story that I might tell about you. The point of the vichara is not to gain understanding. It's not to gain relief from pain. It's not to gain peace. It's not to gain or attain or become anything. The purpose of the vichara is to bring you in direct, unmediated contact with you. To bring you face to face with you. Not to see anything, not to understand anything, just to look. The whole of the vichara, as it is an act performed by the individual persona, is nothing other than a looking. And when I say taste or experience or any of the other foolishness that I use from time to time to try to evoke in you a sense of what it is that I want you to see, you can forget all of that. It's you. That's what I want you to look at. I want you to look at you. Now, this looking at yourself is not like a duty. It's not like systematic meditation practice that requires that you do anything, really. That you breathe right, that you sit right, that you prepare right, that you do it at a certain time and for a certain duration and in a certain way. This looking at yourself that I speak of is quite informal. It's quite casual. It's quite easy. I don't think casual is exactly the word, but it's quite easy. And it requires no time at all. It can be done pretty much continuously because it can be done in just the split second when for just 1 second you stop what you're doing, you stop looking at what you are looking at and look to see, look at you. Just you. Not to see anything. We see everything. The truth is that there's never a moment, never a nanosecond of time when we are not seeing ourself. Never. There is never a moment in time when we are not seeing the absolute reality of the real. Never. So the movement of the vichara has nothing whatsoever to do with seeing something you haven't seen. You are always seeing yourself. You're never absent. You can't help but be seeing yourself. You're just not looking at yourself. The vichara is entirely a looking. Now, as it happens, the magnificent thing about this insight that comes to us from Ramana is that there's no way to do it right. And there's no way to do it wrong. Your goal is to look at yourself, not all the time, and not in order to gain understanding, and not in order to lose confusion, but just to look at yourself in order that this endless driving need to establish identity will die. This endless driving belief that we are in danger here, at stake here, and that we have got to get something right, that we have got to be something that works, something that is clear and clean and true and enlightened, that whole idea just vanishes. the purpose of looking at yourself is to settle the issue of identity. The effect of this looking, the effect of the settling of the issue of identity on the life itself is gradual. It occurs over time, and it is indirect. If you succeed in looking at yourself directly, which I don't see how you can fail, if you succeed in looking at yourself directly, the fact is that the aspects and characteristics of the way your persona presents itself in the world will change. The aspects of the way your persona presents itself in the world in order to protect itself and to define itself and to understand its relationship with the world and with others and its relationship with itself, those things will vanish over time. They'll dissipate and go. The way that your persona looks to itself and looks in the world will change over time. Not because the new way of being is free and the old way of being was not free, but because the old way of being, once the vichara is underway, has no purpose anymore. There's nothing that you need to do to protect yourself from anything that could possibly harm you, since you cannot possibly be harmed, and you know it. So all of those features of the persona that are dedicated to self-protection and self-definition and the establishment of identity, those things, as they have no further purpose, they vanish over time. Doesn't mean that you're going to turn into a saint or an avatar or anything of the kind. You don't need to be a saint. You don't need to be a sinner. You are what you are, and you have always been that. And you have never not seen that. The vichara, the self-inquiry of Ramana Maharshi, has nothing whatsoever to do with anything at all that's going on in your mind. Has nothing whatsoever to do with what you think you are, or with what you think reality is, or what you think the source of pain and suffering is, or what you think happiness is. It has nothing to do with any of that. It has to do merely with bringing your personal consciousness in direct, naked, open-eyed, unmediated contact with the reality of you, which is here always, not special, ordinary. It's this looking that does the work. Now, it is certainly the case that often great insights and great breakthroughs, seeming magnificent understandings of the nature of reality, will strike you in the course of the vichara. They strike you already in the course of whatever else you're doing. The insights and the magnificent clear seeing and the open-heartedness and the generosity and the all of that may very well strike you in the course of the vichara mean nothing. You can see if you will look. Everything I say, if I say anything that you think that you have to believe, then you should ignore me. Because everything I say, when I say something to you, it's because I have the direct experience that you can verify this for yourself simply by looking at things, simply by looking at you. And these understandings and these insights, as wonderful and fresh and enlivening as they may appear, they actually cause nothing. They actually have no effect whatsoever on you, on your life, on your ability or capacity to be happy and free or anything else. They are kisses. They are moments of pleasurable sensation that arise and then depart. and you remain. So the purpose of the vichara is not to gain understanding. The purpose of the vichara is to eradicate within you the deep-seated, entirely inferential, unseeable belief that you are at stake here, that you're in danger here, that there are things here that can harm you and things here that can help you. None of this is true. The beauty of the method of the vichara, the beauty of it is that it requires no merit. It doesn't require a clear mind. You are not asked to stop thought. You are not asked to empty your mind. You are not asked to do anything whatsoever, except whenever it occurs to you to do so, look at yourself. Look. Just look. Nothing more to it than that. Just look. Now, what you are to look for, as I said, it would be, seem to me to be huge foolishness for me to try to tell you what you are, or where you are to find yourself, or what you feel like, or any of that. But what you are to look for is just you. It's a cliche joke that when someone gets kind of older and the body is starting to show signs of wear and tear and so forth, kind of like this body that I am familiar with here, it's kind of a cliche joke to put an old geezer like me in front of a mirror and see his surprise at what he sees, because he knows that he's the same as he's always been. Just as you know that you are the same as you have always been. You are the same now as you were when you were 3. You are the same now as you were 5 minutes ago. You are the same now as you will be 5 years from now. You have never changed, and you know it. And it is that ordinary sense of you-ness, unchanging, persisting you-ness, that you are to look at. Just that. Now, it's often the case in the course of this that, and in many spiritual teachings, high-level spiritual teachings, we are taught that we are inexistent, that we are not, in fact. But that can't be true. We know better than that. We are here. There are many, many aspects of our attempts to define ourselves. The attempt to define ourselves which itself arises from the desperate need to establish an identity that will be safe and secure and open to fulfillment. There are many things that we can look at that we have projected identity upon, our own identity upon, that upon looking at them they will disappear. One of the two lines of inquiry that Ramana Maharshi always taught people, the two lines of inquiry, one is what I am speaking to you now about, which is to look at yourself, not the Atma self, not the capital S self, just you. There are not two selves, it's just you. To look at that certainty of being that's always here, that shining presence that's always here. Just look at it, not to get anything from it. The other method of self-inquiry that Ramana Maharshi taught to people was the method of looking at ego. And I think that what he means by ego is just any old internal experience that feels like what you might think to be ego, you know, contracted and selfish and fearful and and ever alert, ever vigilant to what's happening, keeping life at arm's length, lest a wrong thought intrude or a wrong desire intrude or a misunderstanding intrude. To look at that ego, to look at some internal sensation within you that feels like the pathetic and pitiful me that needs and does not get, that thirsts and is not satisfied, that ego thing, to look at that, and in fact Ramana goes so far as to advise us to grab it by the throat, to hold it by the throat. But it doesn't matter what the actual sensational, the phenomenal sensation is that you look at, if it feels like the center of the problem, you can look at that and you will see that that which feels most intimately to be the problem child, the one that needs to be fixed or destroyed, that itself will disappear. It will vanish under your gaze. And the conclusion that's drawn from that, that we are therefore in existence, to me, is absurd. I mean, it can't hurt you to believe that, but it's just absurd. When the false, when that which you have falsely thought to be yourself is gone, you remain. In the second following the vanishing of this false center of misery and hatefulness and suffering and lack and so forth, when that disappears, you are left looking directly at you. And that's all there is to the purpose of looking at ego. When ego goes, you remain, and there you are, looking at you. Now, although it is really, really easy to speak about the ever-present reality of you that's never gone, that's never absent, that's ordinary in every sense, and therefore in its very ordinariness becomes difficult to look at, the fact is that this reality that you are, that is absolutely cannot be denied, really, you know, when you reflect upon it, you will see that it's possible for you to deny that everything is in exists, to claim, to believe, to assert that everything is inexistent, that there is nothing that exists, that I am inexistent, that I, who now am speaking into your ears, is inexistent and merely a hallucination of some sort, that the desk you sit at or the computer you are looking at, that too is just a vision, a hallucination that you've created in your mind, that the thoughts, they too are, if looked at, are seen to be inexistent. They have no substance to them, no reality to them. Everything you can look at, everything you can see, everything whatsoever in the world about you, you can convincingly and reasonably, rationally deny as being existent phenomena. But not you. Nothing you can do. No philosophical contortions or metaphysical contortions or any contortions of any kind will persuade you that you are not. And it is that certainty that is in the direction that I want you to look. It is that certainty that you are here. You are here. You know that. Look there. You won't see anything because you're invisible. You are invisible in the same sense that that material light is invisible. You can't see light, you can't see a photon, nor can you see you. But it's not the seeing that matters, it's the looking. And the magnificence of Ramana's insight, the unbelievable power of Ramana's insight resides precisely in this. All that's needed is to look. You don't need to see anything. You don't need to understand anything. You don't need to rid yourself of any understanding. You don't need to believe anything. You don't need to rid yourself of any belief. You don't need to practice anything. You don't need to rid yourself of any practice. All you need to do is look. Look at this unmoving, ever-present you. Just look. I wouldn't expect any immediate explosion of enlightenment or realization or anything of the kind. The persona that we have so fallen in love with as our avatar in the world, the persona itself is entirely mechanical. It is formed and shaped and shifted and changed entirely due to its context. It is the skin of its context, the face of its context. And it changes as the context changes over time. It is entirely conditional. It is not subject to sudden enlightenment. It is not subject to a sudden transformation from ignorance to clarity. It's not subject to ignorance, nor is it subject to clarity. It is display only. So I wouldn't expect any startling insights or startling revelations or a sudden opening of the persona to become a saint or an avatar or a clear-seeing, wonderful creature that everyone loves. Wouldn't expect any of that. Anything can happen. But what you can expect, if you will just undertake this one simple practice, this one simple undertaking to look at yourself whenever it occurs to you to do so, if you will begin that, what you can expect is, first of all, that it will continue. It will, in fact, for many, it seems to take on a mind of its own, so to speak, a life of its own. It will continue. The moving of attention, the moving of your attention into the direction that actually, without fail, will bring an end to the misery in life, that moving of attention finally into the right direction will begin the irrepressible, the irresistible movement there again and again. The inquiry will return. Whether you try to do it or try to make it stop, it will return. That's one thing. That's the main confirming sign of the vichara, is that it happens. Now I tell you to do this whenever it occurs to you to do so, and I tell you that in those terms, in that sense, because I want you to see how absolutely without discipline and neediness this possibility is. You don't have to plan to do it. You don't have to not plan to do it. All you have to do is that whenever the thought occurs to you, do it. Look at yourself. Just look at yourself whenever you can. 100 times a day, once a week. Doesn't matter. once it starts occurring, once it starts manifesting, it will use whatever mechanism is at its comes to hand. It will use the feeling that you've remembered to do it, or you will remember something I've said, or you'll remember something you said to the people around you, or something will bring it to your mind, and you'll just take a real quick look at yourself and gasp. But it will return. It will continue. That's how you tell that it's actually doing its job. The other thing that you can expect is not quite so evident always. And that is that over time, and sometimes it is so gradual that you don't even notice that it's happening until you look back. But over time, you will notice that this undercurrent of fearfulness and anxiety, the sometimes that is very big and very a fire and a blaze, and sometimes it's just a little murmuring impetus to have to keep an eye on things, to have to watch out for things, to have to be careful about what you think, to have to be careful about what you say, be careful about how you look at yourself. That this undercurrent of fearfulness and anxiety will diminish and finally be gone forever. But you'll notice it diminishing over time. Sometimes it takes a long time. God knows in this life it took what seems to be a long time. Other times it seems to happen very quickly, the losing of this fearfulness and anxiety. But it always goes, whether slowly or quickly, it always goes once you start just looking at yourself. You don't have to stop anything else you're doing. You don't even have to give credit to the vichara for what happens. All you have to do is look at yourself as often as you can, and I promise you, the day will come when you will see that life is far from being dangerous, far from being a trap or a false promise or anything like that. That life, your life, just exactly as it is continuously unfolding, ever changing, ever moving, ever unreliable, ever crazy, that your life, now listen to this, your life, just as it is, already is, has always has been, and for as long as it persists, always will be exactly what you have sought in the name of self-realization. You will see that your life is the actual realization of reality. It is your life is a stream in the huge ocean of the vichara, which is itself not a technique for making me free, not a practice that comes from 2,000 years ago, not a path toward enlightenment, but the vichara is all of creation. You will see for yourself that reality, whether by whatever name you call it, whether you call it by the name of awareness or God or self or Krishna or no matter what you call it, that in the reality is an absolutely irrepressible need, requirement. Let me use requirement. A requirement to see itself. And that requirement within reality, that it see itself, is the whole of creation. And your life, just as it is, just as it unfolds, just as it's always changing, is the self-realization that you have sought for all the time you have been seeking spiritual solution to the problem of human life. But all that's beside the point. That's just my attempt, inept and inadequate attempt, to do what others have failed to do with much greater poetry and beauty than I have, which is to say something real about reality, to say something real about the nature of existence. And I tell you that so far as I can see, the nature of existence is reality, the requirement within reality that it see itself. This is not so different from something that Papaji once said that really caught my attention years ago, when he said, the self is endlessly interested in seeing itself. And I am convinced that Papaji saw that same thing, that reality is endlessly requiring to see itself, and that is the source of creation, and that you as reality endlessly require that you see yourself, and that is the self-realization, the self made manifest in the world that is your life. But that's all beside the point. The only point for me, truly, and the only reason that I meet with you like this, and the only reason that I speak with anybody as I do about these matters, is because I have seen in my own life, in my own experience, and in the experience and lives and reports of hundreds of people who have been speaking with me about these matters over the last 10 years, I have seen beyond all possibility of denial that if you will just look at yourself, simply forget about all that creation and self-realization and the nature of the vichara that I just went on a little trip about. If you will look at yourself without regard to any of that, because that's all made up, just look at yourself without regard to anything whatsoever except once and for all to settle the issue of identity. Just to look at yourself. That's it. Just look at you. That if you will do that, everything will come out right in the end. Everything will be made clear in the end. And in no way is it possible for anybody to predict what that means, that everything will be clear in the end. But that it will is certain. If you will do this, look at yourself whenever you can, whenever it occurs to you to do so. I know I go on a lot, and I would have to say that probably 99% of what I say is beside the point. At least 99% of what I say is beside the point. Most of what I say to try to inspire or encourage or you know, implant some energy to do this. What I say, the only thing that I say that is not beside the point is look at yourself. Look. Just look. You are here. You are never absent. You never, ever, ever are absent from yourself. Just look whenever you can. and see what happens. Okay. I'm done. If anybody wants to speak with me about any of this, to argue with me or anything, just talk about any of this. I think Carla has already told you how to do that by whatever it is that you have to do. So I'll be here waiting. Thank you for listening to me. Thank you for your time.
Vanky in North Carolina.
Hi, Vanky. How's the weather there? Is it raining?
Yeah, it stopped raining. John, Hurricane Hannah, or Tropical Storm Hannah, is on its way out. So the weather is beautiful now, actually. So I hope you and Carl are doing fine.
Oh, we're very well. I'm glad to see you here, Vanky. What can I do for you?
I had one question, John, and it's not really related to the self-inquiry, but I have a report too. I mean, after all this mental acrobatics, the vichara continues undeniably, for reasons totally unknown to me. Even the intent to do it is also not mine. At this point, I can confidently say that I have no idea what you're talking about. Totally, completely. I have really no clue. And I can come up with 1,000 explanations for this, whether it feels pleasurable or painful, both seem equally true. And the one undeniable thing is somehow I am here. I don't know how, don't know who, but I'm here, and it's never changed. That's also self-evidently true. Cannot logically explain it, but the fact of it remains that now I listen to you, and individually, all your recordings and what you just said, even now, makes sense if I explored one at a time. But the totality of it is somehow incomprehensible. So that's what I mean by saying that I'm truly clueless, but I'm not uncomfortable with being clueless. So that's pretty unique. I never expected to be at this point or feel this way.
Well, me too. I mean, we're in the same boat. I'm as clueless as you are and as happy to be clueless as you are, but I just talk more. The things that I say, I don't intend to be a new vision of things that people now should believe instead of their old vision of things. Quite the contrary. In fact, it's probably pretty good that I'm not more articulate than I am, because if I were, then I might be able to implant some new beliefs. And it's not that beliefs are bad, and it's not that they're good. It's just that they are beside the point. When we look, we see. What I see so clearly, just as you do. I see so clearly, just as you do. But when I try to speak of what I see, I stammer and stutter and stumble and get lost in a forest of words and ideas. But what we see is indisputable. When we look, what we see is indisputable. And that's why I come back always to the one thing that I really have to offer, which is the encouragement to look at yourself. And your report is an encouragement to all. I'm very happy to hear that you are clueless and not disturbed by that. Anything else?
Yeah, I'm happy to hear what you said, John. It's actually the movement of being comfortable with cluelessness is completely opposite to how we have been taught to live life, or what we thought mattered, or the structures we had built in our heads about life itself. So it's actually pretty, it's also ordinary. It's not like, oh, I have a different view of life now and I'm like free and all that, but It's pretty simple, actually, and that's a relief. I have a question, and I don't know if this is directly related to self-inquiry or not, but probably one of the main reasons why, and this is all speculation, but why I got into, like, hearing all these people on the fringe, like Krishnamurti or people who have a different or an outsider's view of life, is I've always been bothered by the things that the human intellect touches, like science and genetics, and even these spiritual endeavors are absolutely fabulous that the mind is able to, like, express things like mathematics or science or computers, and it's unbelievable how it can do it. But these ideas seem to spread like a virus and come back and, you know, like, hit humanity, because it seems that no matter what we invent or create, it goes away into the field of creating more misery and suffering, and I don't know what is there some kind of intellectual responsibility towards the world in not creating new ideas, because, you know, we have seen that every idea demonstrably creates to more misery and loss of life. So what is it from a point of view of a person who is practically capable of creating new things? Is there a responsibility not to spread the idea so that it doesn't come back and hit humanity, or is that view a very narrow, constrictive view seen from inside the belief? I don't know if you understood what I asked, but oh well.
I think I understand what you're asking, and let me see if I can rephrase it so that you can tell me whether I do understand what you're asking. What you seem to be saying to me is you point out the fact that in all of the history of humanity, everything that human beings have done by means of intellectual understanding or the creation of ideas or even the creation of things in the world for that start out with good intent, but in more to the point of this particular meeting, this particular context, the context is the possibility of a spiritual solution, that everything we say creates new ideas, which are then, unless they're either forgotten or they are picked up and made into something that further circumscribes us and strengthens the bars of our cage. And therefore, is it not the responsibility of those who have some position or facility for spreading new ideas to be careful with doing that, kind of? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, John, exactly. I mean, if tomorrow somebody decodes all of DNA, and if it is let loose in the world as it is today, I see nothing but the possibility of destruction. Maybe I'm a cynic, but this is what has happened consistently. I don't know where all this fits in with what we are trying to do to end the false belief about what we are.
Well, yeah, well, it's actually quite clear to me how it would fit into this whole business. You have to see that what we are doing, what we spend most of our lifetime doing, is trying to establish an identity. And what I mean by that is that we are trying to arrive at definitions, self-definitions, that are satisfactory and safe, and that are not going to cause us trouble, and that are going to make us eligible for the promise of life to be fulfilled, and ineligible for further harm to come to us within this life. And that's true even of the things that we do when we are exploring the worlds of science and physics and astronomy and astrophysics and mathematics and philosophy, especially philosophy. Of course, philosophy is itself, pretty much, an exercise of self-definition. For me, as I sit here speaking to people who, for reasons that often perplex me, listen to me, for me, I am very aware of the power of a nicely presented idea to be taken up as a new component of the self-definition that is the goal of this underlying urgent impulse to establish an identity. But the truth is that all of that is actually beside the point. Our problem, as it turns out, has nothing whatsoever to do with the things that we take up to try to arrive at a definition of ourselves. It's not the things that are the problem. It's not the life that is the problem. It's not thought that is the problem. It's not self-definition that is the problem. It's not understanding or lack of understanding that is the problem. The problem, entirely, really, without a step further than this, the problem entirely is this underlying conviction that there is for us hope and salvation and danger and risk within this life. That there is for us a right way to approach it and a wrong way to approach it, and that the consequences can be quite profound. The consequences of choosing the right way of approach and the wrong way of approach in any moment, in any circumstance, in any choice that's presented to us. The idea that there's a profound, something very profound is at stake in that. The fact is that that's just simply not the case. The things we are talking about that, like confusion and misunderstanding and wrong ideas and, oh, I don't know, attachment or dissociation or any of the psychological components of the confused individual persona, these things don't touch us at all. They really don't. They don't cause us any harm. They don't help us at all. The huge experiences of awakening and clear seeing and all of that, that doesn't help us. And the experiences of being trapped and the experience of misery and suffering that arises from this endless effort to define ourselves, that really doesn't touch us either. Not even the search for the establishment of identity really causes us harm. It's just such a waste of time, a waste of this life, a waste of energy, unnecessary. But it doesn't hurt us. None of it hurts us. And that's what you see, Vanki, when you report the fact that you have never changed. When you report that, what you're reporting from is the certainty that you've never changed, which means that you've never been helped or hurt by anything whatsoever that transpired in your life or in your mind or in your spirit or anything else. You are the same. So the purpose of the vichara, and although I do try to be careful to wave red flags and say don't believe anything I say and all of that, I also know that that's it might be unrealistic expectation that anybody will follow that. But the only thing that I want to come out of everything that I say is that anybody who is listening to me, and even if you believe what I say, even if you take it and run with it as a new religion, if while doing that you will turn and look at yourself whenever you can, everything will come out right. Everything we have tried to do in the past that has not worked for 5,000 years has been connected with trying to figure out what is the right approach to life and what is the wrong approach to life. Is it right for me to try to understand what I am, to try to see the nature of reality, to try to be taken and enriched and elevated and so forth by new ideas and fresh understandings and great insights. Is that the right approach? Is that the wrong approach? Or is the right approach more for me to retreat and have nothing whatsoever to do with the understanding that human intellect is capable of, to shun it as sinful and something that will cause me harm, something that will prevent me from being what I already am? You see how silly that sounds? Something that will prevent me from being what I already am. And all of our efforts in the whole realm of spiritual solution, including religion, for 5,000 years, have been devoted to trying to do something about this mind, something about this life, something about what I'm doing wrong, something that make me do it right, something that will make me see clearly and be able to avoid the pitfalls and the misunderstandings and the stupidity that I have been subject to in the past. And that doesn't work. If it worked, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in now. That doesn't work. The only thing that works, and, you know, it's not that it's quite useful to have these discussions, like the discussion I'm having with you. But the only thing that works, and the only reason this discussion is valuable, is if it causes somebody to hear that it's not that, none of that needs to be changed. None of that needs to be kept from changing. All that needs to happen is that we look at ourselves nakedly, with eyes wide open, without the mediation of understanding, without the mediation even of understanding that it's impossible to understand. That's all this is about. The vichara, to the vichara, within the vichara, within the ever-unfolding, shifting, changing display that is the vichara, the display, the particulars of the display are beside the point. Within the life, many of those things are far from beside the point. But from the vichara, all of those things are beside the point. Within the vichara, the whole engine of needing to get things right vanishes. The whole engine that drives the need to see the difference between the value of understanding and the danger of understanding, that departs. It's irrelevant. Then it all is seen for what it is, which is manifest display of the reality of what you are. You follow me?
Yes, John. I kind of got you midway over there, what you were trying to get. It seems like, you summed it up beautifully. The value versus the danger of understanding, this is something that we are constantly doing without having any logical need to take either side. You know, value versus danger, we choose either side based on how we are feeling at that moment. So it's kind of absurd what we do. It's very silly because neither the value nor the danger of understanding actually kind of touches us in a way, to so to speak. And I saw another parallel to my question is like, we keep thinking, oh, if I can change a society in a positive way, it'll be fine. But actually what we are thinking is, if I can change society in a way that it will not harm me anymore, then things will be fine. You know, we neglect that second portion. It's like a cognitive blind spot for us, the way we think. And I think that has been exposed to a large extent from doing this absurdly simple thing that you suggest, but it's so hard to hear it. And it's great, and as usual, thank you a lot, John, and best of luck to you and Carl.
You're very welcome, Venky. Thank you very much. I'm happy to speak with you. Anybody else?
Eden, calling from Moline, Illinois.
My eating?
My experience with the vichara is that the effect seems to create a bliss. And I would like to know your response to this.
Well, it's not so much the vichara that creates bliss. Bliss is something that a state that comes and goes. And it's certainly true that I suppose that it's not surprising that bliss would appear. I've had that experience myself in the practice of the vichara. But the thing about bliss, it's not bad. I mean, no, it would be pretty silly to say that bliss was bad. The thing about bliss is that it comes and goes. You remain. You are the source of that bliss. You are that into which the bliss resolves when it disappears. But the bliss comes and goes, and the other thing about bliss is that it is so powerfully pleasurable that it is natural that we would try to add that into our definition of ourself to enhance and enable the whole business of self-definition. But there's nothing wrong with it, and, you know, it's enjoy it while it's here, and look at yourself when it's gone, okay?
Okay? Well, there is something. Maybe it isn't bliss, I don't know, but there is something that accompanies my vichara, and it is... And no matter what else is going on, even if I go into all kinds of different other emotions, there's something that accompanies this vichara experience. And it's very, I don't know what to call it. Maybe it's not bliss, but it's significant.
Is it here now?
It is.
Does it ever depart?
It is remaining more and more. In the past, it has departed, but it is remaining now.
And you, what about you? Are you here?
Definitely.
Have you ever departed?
No.
Then I wouldn't be concerned about it one way or the other, what it is. It is just part of the phenomenal arising that is creation, is the realization itself. It is the life itself. It's just a component in that. But I wouldn't worry about what it is. I mean, you're here. That's everything else is in reference to that. You follow me?
I'm not sure if I am following you, honestly. I will say one thing, and that is that as long as this has been happening, there's definitely more cohesiveness to the vichara.
Well, that's good news then. Perhaps what it is the vichara. I mean, everything is, after all. I mean, I'm not, you know, don't misunderstand me, Eden. I'm not saying that there, what I am saying literally, and I mean this absolutely literally, is that there's no need for you to come up with any idea of what this is or is not. It is here when it's here. It is not here when it's not here. And it is helpful, apparently. And beyond that, what can be said about it? I'm very happy that it's present with you, whatever it is. Okay?
Good enough.
The main thing, and I can tell you that the vichara is often accompanied by very profoundly I don't even know what possible adjective to use for this, but the vichara is often accompanied by feelings of potency and clarity and confidence. And that's to be expected and welcome here. But everything's welcome. The most important thing, I think that the most important thing about what you're saying is that, that things are better. The vichara is working. Okay?
Thank you so much, John.
You're very, very welcome, Eden. Let me hear more from you as time goes on. Everybody, please let me know how you're doing over time. Anybody else want to talk to me?
Travis in San Francisco, California.
Hi, Travis.
Hi, John. How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
I just wanted to touch base with you and to thank you today for talking about identity specifically. As I told you before, I met...
Travis, you've lost your microphone somehow. I can't hear anything. Don't know what happened, but no sound. I'd love to hear what you have to say. Maybe your microphone came unplugged if you have it plugged into something.
Yeah, my computer does this weird thing sometimes. Sorry about that.
Computers.
Totally. Yeah, I work in tech support, so I have to deal with them all day. I just wanted to thank you for talking specifically about identity today and to say that it really resonated with me for a recent experience that I had with my daily meditation practice. I found myself, and I think I've been doing this for a long time, to sort of taking on the stories of other people's supposed big enlightenment experiences where they hear a bird chirping or a car honk outside or something happens and suddenly they realize identification with that thing completely and then they're sort of liberated from self-identification. And I found myself, a bird chirped outside and I found myself just waiting, just like, okay, here it comes, here it comes, here it comes. And I laughed at the silliness of that because here I am already here just fine as I am waiting for this big change that that you often talk about this and that the other speaker today talked about the fixing of the self and here I am the whole time already here waiting for this here-ness to somehow be different and. Through it all, I was there, and I was just fine, and everything was just okay. And it seems to me to be recently in, with this practice, this vichara, that identification has become more of a game to play with. I don't mean that in a sense of, like, trying to win something or be better than. I just mean that I see where I habitually take identification left, right, up and down and whatever I need to do in the moment, but that I can be freer from keeping a permanent identification, if that makes any sense. Like when I'm at work, I'm doing my work, and when I'm driving, I'm paying attention to driving so nobody gets hurt, and when I'm with my wife, I'm playing that role of being a husband and enjoying the hell out of it, and that I don't seem to as much be locked into needing to be a set identity, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it makes perfect sense. Yes, absolutely. You know, it's not, you know, we have concluded, somewhere along the line, we concluded that the fundamental spiritual problem is misidentification. And it's that conclusion that we arrived at, God knows how many thousands of years ago, that has plagued us ever since. Partly because the problem is not misidentification. I was speaking to a group of people the other day, and I pointed out to them what you just said. In fact, it's almost a direct quote. When I'm driving in the car, I'm identified as the driver of that car. When I'm cooking dinner, I'm identified as the guy who's cooking dinner. And when I'm out shopping for groceries, I'm the guy that's shopping for groceries. And that doesn't cause me any distress at all. None whatsoever. It's not misidentification that causes the suffering and the distress. What causes the suffering and distress is the perceived, desperately urgent need to find an identity. The perceived, desperately urgent need to find an identity that will stay and be safe and be right in all cases and be clear and fearless and all of that. And of course, since it is identity itself that is seeking to find identity, this particular lunacy can only create more havoc. Similarly, the lunacy that arises from our attempt to destroy identity in the name of ending misidentification is also a lunacy that can only create more suffering and more misery. The truth is that, as you say, you are here. You are absolutely untouched by any of the identifications that come and go in the story of your life that's endlessly changing and unfolding. You are the same. You've never changed. And you are that which bestows upon everything whatsoever identity. You are that, the bestower of identity. So yeah, I'm glad to hear that. It's amazing the amount of misery that we cause ourselves with half-baked spiritual ideas. Thank you for that report, Travis.
Thank you, John. And yeah, I think that what you just talked about is exactly why I find your transmission of Ramana Maharshi's teachings so valuable, because I struggled with them before encountering your YouTube videos. And part of the thing that I realize now is this question, who am I or what am I, begs for a new identity. It begs for us to find a different form than what we currently are, that we can occupy and have be okay, as you say, have be safe or free of consequence. And in your urging just to look at what is, what we are now, and in using the term Atmavichara, which I think frees it up from that associations of those words or those definitions that have come to us over time, I think is incredibly useful.
Well, I hope so. That certainly is my intent. I see is that we've been getting it wrong for a long time, and it's not because there are any evildoers that are misleading us, or although there may be people misleading us, and there may even be people that mislead us with ill intent and so forth, but that's not the cause of our mistake, our wrong turning. I don't know what the cause of our wrong turning is, but we've been doing this for a long time. And for a long time, we have taken the question, who am I, to be an invitation to construct a new identity, a better identity than the one that has, than the many identities that have been passing through us up until now. When in reality, of course, the question, who am I, and the question, what am I, as put to us by Ramana. And Ramana's a radical break from the past. It may be difficult for us in this culture and society to see that to be the case because of his vocabulary and history and so forth, but he's a radical break from the past. When those questions are put to us by Ramana, the only thing that he calls upon us to do is look. Just look. And it's very easy to miss that. Very, very easy to miss that. Many, many more do than don't in the context in which it appears to us. So if I can be useful at all, it is there. It is to is to point to what it is that Ramana actually saw, the heart of Ramana's insight, which is the simple looking, that after which everything is made clear. Okay?
Yeah, I like that a lot. And I think a large part of the problem has just been, as you always say, that the immense difficulty of speaking, how inconceivably simple the truth of what we are is. And I just wanted to say something about what the last speaker, Eden, said. I think that, for me anyway, that the vichara doesn't bring a state of bliss. I think what it does is make me more bliss prone. And I think I would call it a feeling of contentment, that when the feeling of danger of being in at risk in this life goes, when the vichara does its work and slowly erodes that, the sort of peak experiences where that erosion is most apparent, that simple ordinary contentment is such a shock, is so different from what our normal at risk, running around, making sure everything's okay, thinking of a million things, hoping we don't forget our social security numbers and the numbers to our bank accounts and our checkbook balances and whether we get to work on time and we'll remember to call this person, that person, all of that stuff. When that risk for a moment just kind of is gone, or whatever it does, when the vichara punches through that for just a second, the feeling of contentment is so simple, but such a contrast that it's very striking. At least that's my experience.
I think that is really quite a sharp cutting through all of that. I agree with you entirely. It is entirely, and I suspect that Eden would agree as well. It is entirely this simple contentment that is revealed when the fearfulness and anxiety is missing. And that certainly is my experience as well, and it's just, life is sweet. And you know, all those things that we do out of fear that we will do something wrong still get done. It's just that the fearfulness associated with them has found another home somewhere. So that was beautiful, Travis. That's great. That's exactly what I should have said to her. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Due to the nature of this medium, you can't hear me cracking up when you're speaking. But thank you again for being you. And thank you, Carla, for working so hard to make this happen. And I wish you both well.
Yeah, likewise. And it's the same for me. Everybody, often I crack up when I hear the sweet things that you people have to say. And, of course, it's the nature of the medium that you don't get to hear that. But anybody else?
Justin in Steamboat Springs, Colorado.
Hi, Justin.
Hi. Is the mic working any better?
Yes, I can hear you fine now.
Okay, well, let's see. Sometimes when I try to talk about this stuff, it doesn't come out so well, because maybe I don't need to talk about it.
It's okay.
Okay. Well, I thought before I started to, I started listening to your podcast a couple weeks ago, and well, previously in the past, there have been certain words that have helped me direct the attention towards that reality. For some reason, it's hard for me to talk right now.
It's okay. You can talk or not.
In the past, it seems that certain pointers, words such as background presence, or stillness or thought-free awareness that I've heard, these seem to help point my attention to that. And I kind of had a little bit of, I've read some stuff about this before I became interested in Ramana's teachings, and then after reading some of Ramana's stuff, I ended up finding your podcast. You know, I think I just want to say thank you, and you really helped change my life.
Well, there's certainly no need to say more than that, and you are absolutely wonderful. I'm very grateful that you would make the effort to say what you said. Don't hesitate to be in touch with me. Don't hesitate to email me. And don't hesitate to show up at the other meetings and talk anytime you want to. I'm very happy to hear from you. Okay?
Okay. Thanks, John, and thanks, Carla.
Okay, you're welcome. Anybody else? Okay. I think we've probably been here long enough. I'm really, really thrilled with the way that, with the conversations and the way this meeting has gone. You guys are amazing. You know, and it's not just the ones who speak. We're all here together. We're all in this together. And you guys are amazing, and I'm really, grateful to you to have you here, to have you in this conversation with me, to see people who are willing to just look at yourself, you know, not make things go away, not make things stay, not do a new practice, not get rid of your old beliefs, not any of that. Just to look at yourself. Because the truth is that everything I say, all of the words that I weave, all of the stories that I tell, all of it is beside the point. The only reason that I come to you, the only reason that I go anywhere, the only reason that I speak to anybody, really, is to offer what has been, brought an end, an absolute end to discontent. And Travis says contentment, it's another new word I have for the opposite of contentment, which is discontent. To bring to you news, the really great, unbelievable, remarkable, startling good news of how easy it is to be finished with discontent in this life. Of how easy it is, because the ending of discontent is you. And you've always been here. And you've always known that. And all that's required is to look at what you already know. To look at you. As often as you can. Whenever it occurs to you. Look at you. Again, thank you from the bottom of my heart for your attention and your conversations with me. You are the... I am your servant. I love you all. I will see you when I see you. Carla has a couple of things she wants to say to you. And I will see you when I see you. I love you all. Bye.